Jane's headlamp now appeared down the tunnel, and the sound of squealing brakes pierced the air. As the train burst into the station and began slowing down, Simpkins and his two agents leaned out over the track, waving CIA identification badges and straining to make eye contact with the conductor before he could open the doors. The train was closing fast. In the third car, Simpkins finally saw the startled face of the conductor, who was apparently trying to figure out why three men in black were all waving identification badges at him. Simpkins jogged toward the train, which was now nearing a full stop.
CIA, Simpkins shouted, holding up his ID. Do not open the doors.
As the train glided slowly past him, he went toward the conductor's car, shouting in at him.
Do not open your doors. Do you understand? Do not open your doors.
The train came to a full stop, its wide-eyed conductor nodding repeatedly.
What's wrong?
The man demanded through his side window.
Don't let this train move, Simpkins said, and don't open the doors.
Okay.
Can you let us into the first car?
The conductor nodded, looking fearful. He stepped out of the train, closing the door behind him. He escorted Simpkins and his men to the first car, where he manually opened the door.
Lock it behind us, Simpkins said, pulling his weapon.
Simpkins and his men stepped quickly into the stark light of the first car. The conductor locked the door behind them. The first car contained only four passengers, three teenage boys and an old woman, all of whom looked understandably startled to see three armed men entering. Simpkins held up his ID.
Everything's fine. Just stay seated.
Simpkins and his men now began their sweep, pushing toward the back of the sealed train one car at a time, squeezing toothpaste, as it was called, during his training at the farm. Very few passengers were on this train, and halfway to the back, the agents still had seen nobody even remotely resembling the description of Robert Langdon and Catherine Solomon. Nonetheless, Simpkins remained confident. There was absolutely no place to hide on a subway car. No bathrooms, no storage, and no alternative exits. Even if the targets had seen them board the train and fled to the back, there was no way out. Prying open a door was almost impossible, and Simpkins had men watching the platform and both sides of the train anyway.
Patience.
By the time Simpkins reached the second-to-last car, however, he was feeling edgy. This penultimate car had only one passenger, a Chinese man. Simpkins and his agents moved through, scanning for any place to hide. There was none.
Last car,
Simpkins said, raising his weapon as the threesome moved toward the threshold of the train's final section. As they stepped into the last car, all three of them immediately stopped and stared.
What the?
Simpkins raced to the rear of the deserted cabin, searching behind all the seats. He spun back to his men, blood boiling.
Where the hell did they go?
Chapter 79. 8 miles due north of Alexandria, Virginia, Robert Langdon and Catherine Solomon strode calmly across a wide expanse of frost-covered lawn.
You should be an actress, Langdon said, still impressed by Catherine's quick thinking and improvisational skills.
You weren't half bad yourself, she gave him a smile.
At first, Langdon had been mystified by Catherine's abrupt antics in the taxi. Without warning, she had suddenly demanded they go to Freedom Plaza based on some revelation about a Jewish star and the Great Seal of the United States. She drew a well-known conspiracy theory image on a dollar bill and then insisted Langdon look closely where she was pointing. Finally, Langdon realized that Catherine was pointing not at the dollar bill, but at a tiny indicator bulb on the back of the driver's seat. The bulb was so covered with grime that he had not even noticed it. As he leaned forward, however, he could see that the bulb was illuminated, emitting a dull red glow. He could also see the two faint words directly beneath the lit bulb. Intercom on. Startled, Langdon glanced back at Catherine, whose frantic eyes were urging him to look into the front seat. He obeyed, stealing a discreet glance through the divider. The cabbie's cell phone was on the dash, wide open, illuminated, facing the intercom speaker. An instant later, Langdon understood Catherine's actions.
They know we're in this cab. They've been listening to us.
Langdon had no idea how much time he and Catherine had until their taxi was stopped and surrounded, but he knew they had to act fast.
Instantly, he'd begun playing along, realizing that Catherine's desire to go to Freedom Plaza had nothing to do with the pyramid, but rather with its being a large subway station, Metro Center, from which they could take the red, blue, or orange lines in any of six different directions. They jumped out of the taxi at Freedom Plaza, and Langdon took over, doing some improvising of his own, leaving a trail to the Masonic Memorial in Alexandria before he and Catherine ran down into the subway station, dashing past the blue line platforms and continuing on to the red line, where they caught a train in the opposite direction. Traveling six stops northbound to Tenleytown, they emerged all alone into a quiet, upscale neighborhood. Their destination, the tallest structure for miles, was immediately visible on the horizon, just off Massachusetts Avenue, on a vast expanse of manicured lawn. Now off the grid, as Catherine called it, the two of them walked across the damp grass. On their right was a medieval-style garden, famous for its ancient rose bushes and shadow house gazebo. They moved past the garden, directly toward the magnificent building to which they had been summoned, a refuge containing 10 stones from Mount Sinai, one from heaven itself, and one with the visage of Luke's dark father.
"I've never been here at night," Catherine said, gazing up at the brightly lit towers. "It's spectacular."
Langdon agreed, having forgotten how impressive this place truly was. This neo-Gothic masterpiece stood at the north end of Embassy Row. He hadn't been here for years, not since writing a piece about it for a kids' magazine, in hopes of generating some excitement among young Americans to come see this amazing landmark. His article, Moses, Moon Rocks, and Star Wars, had been part of the tourist literature for years. Washington National Cathedral, Langdon thought, feeling an unexpected anticipation at being back after all these years. Where better to ask about one true God?
"This cathedral really has 10 stones from Mount Sinai?" Catherine asked, gazing up at the twin bell towers.
Langdon nodded. "Near the main altar. They symbolize the 10 commandments given to Moses on Mount Sinai."
"And there's a lunar rock?"
"A rock from heaven itself." "Yes, one of the stained glass windows is called the space window and has a fragment of moon rock embedded in it."
"Okay, but you can't be serious about the last thing."
Catherine glanced over, her pretty eyes flashing skepticism.
"A statue of Darth Vader?"
Langdon chuckled. "Luke Skywalker's dark father?" "Absolutely. Vader is one of the National Cathedral's most popular grotesques." He pointed high into the west towers. "Tough to see him at night, but he's there."
"What in the world is Darth Vader doing on Washington National Cathedral?"
"A contest for kids to carve a gargoyle that depicted the face of evil. Darth won." They reached the grand staircase to the main entrance, which was set back in an 80-foot archway beneath a breathtaking rose window. As they began climbing, Langdon's mind shifted to the mysterious stranger who had called him.
"No names, please.
Tell me, have you successfully protected the map that was entrusted to you?" Langdon's shoulder ached from carrying the heavy stone pyramid, and he was looking forward to setting it down.
Sanctuary and answers.
As they approached the top of the stairs, they were met with an imposing pair of wooden doors.
"Do we just knock?" Catherine asked.
Langdon had been wondering the same thing, except that now one of the doors was creaking open.
"Who's there?"
a frail voice said. The face of a withered old man appeared in the doorway. He wore priest's robes and a blank stare. His eyes were opaque and white, clouded with cataracts.
"My name is Robert Langdon," he replied. "Catherine Solomon and I are seeking sanctuary."
The blind man exhaled in relief.
"Thank God. I've been expecting you."
Chapter 80 Warren Bellamy felt a sudden ray of hope. Inside the jungle, Director Sato had just received a phone call from a field agent and had immediately flown into a tirade.
"Well, you damn well better find them,"
she shouted into her phone.
"We're running out of time."
She had hung up and was now stalking back and forth in front of Bellamy as if trying to decide what to do next. Finally, she stopped directly in front of him and turned.
"Mr. Bellamy, I'm going to ask you this once, and only once."
She stared deep into his eyes.
"Yes or no?" Do you have any idea where Robert Langdon might have gone?
Bellamy had more than a good idea, but he shook his head.
No?
Sato's piercing gaze had never left his eyes.
Unfortunately, part of my job is to know when people are lying.
Bellamy averted his eyes.
Sorry, I can't help you.
Architect Bellamy,
Sato said.
Tonight, just after 7 p.m., you were having dinner in a restaurant outside the city when you received a phone call from a man who told you he had kidnapped Peter Solomon.
Bellamy felt an instant chill and returned his eyes to hers.
How could you possibly know that?
The man,
Sato continued,
told you that he had sent Robert Langdon to the Capitol building and given Langdon a task to complete, a task that required your help. He warned that if Langdon failed in this task, your friend Peter Solomon would die. Panicked, you called all of Peter's numbers but failed to reach him. Understandably, you then raced to the Capitol.
Bellamy could not imagine how Sato knew about this phone call.
As you flanked the Capitol,
Sato said behind the smoldering tip of her cigarette,
you sent a text message to Solomon's kidnapper, assuring him that you and Langdon had been successful in obtaining the Masonic Pyramid.
Where is she getting her information? Bellamy wondered. Not even Langdon knows I sent that text message. Immediately after entering the tunnel to the Library of Congress, Bellamy had stepped into the electrical room to plug in the construction lighting. In the privacy of that moment, he had decided to send a quick text message to Solomon's captor, telling him about Sato's involvement, but reassuring him that he, Bellamy, and Langdon had obtained the Masonic Pyramid and would indeed cooperate with his demands. It was a lie, of course, but Bellamy hoped the reassurance might buy time, both for Peter Solomon and also to hide the pyramid.
Who told you I sent a text?
Bellamy demanded. Sato tossed Bellamy's cell phone on the bench next to him.
Hardly rocket science.
Bellamy now remembered his phone and keys had been taken from him by the agents who captured him.
As for the rest of my inside information,
Sato said,
the Patriot Act gives me the right to place a wiretap on the phone of anyone I consider a viable threat to national security. I consider Peter Solomon to be such a threat, and last night I took action.
Bellamy could barely get his mind around what she was telling him.
You're tapping Peter Solomon's phone?
Yes. This is how I knew the kidnapper called you at the restaurant. You called Peter's cell phone and left an anxious message explaining what had just happened.
Bellamy realized she was right.
We had also intercepted a call from Robert Langdon, who was in the Capitol building, deeply confused to learn he had been tricked into coming there. I went to the Capitol at once, arriving before you because I was closer. As for how I knew to check the X-ray of Langdon's bag, in light of my realization that Langdon was involved in all of this, I had my staff re-examine a seemingly innocuous early morning call between Langdon and Peter Solomon's cell phone, in which the kidnapper, posing as Solomon's assistant, persuaded Langdon to come for a lecture and also to bring a small package that Peter had entrusted to him. When Langdon was not forthcoming with me about the package he was carrying, I requested the X-ray of his bag.
Bellamy could barely think. Admittedly, everything Sato was saying was feasible, and yet something was not adding up.
But how could you possibly think Peter Solomon is a threat to national security?
Believe me, Peter Solomon is a serious national security threat,
she snapped.
And frankly, Mr. Bellamy, so are you.
Bellamy sat bolt upright, the handcuffs chafing against his wrists.
I beg your pardon?
She forced a smile.
You Masons play a risky game. You keep a very, very dangerous secret.
Is she talking about the ancient mysteries?
Thankfully, you've always done a good job of keeping your secrets hidden. Unfortunately, recently you've been careless, and tonight, your most dangerous secret is about to be unveiled to the world. And unless we can stop that from happening, I assure you the results will be catastrophic.
Bellamy stared in bewilderment.
If you had not attacked me,
Sato said,
you would have realized that you and I are on the same team.
The same team? The words sparked in Bellamy an idea that seemed almost impossible to fathom. Is Sato a member of Eastern Star?
The Order of the Eastern Star, often considered a sister organization to the Masons, embraced a similar mystical philosophy of benevolence, secret wisdom, and spiritual open-mindedness.
The same team? I'm in handcuffs. She's tapping Peter's phone.
You will help me stop this man,
Sato said.
He has the potential to bring about a cataclysm from which this country might not recover.
Her face was like stone.
Then why aren't you tracking him?
Sato looked incredulous.
Do you think I'm not trying? My trace on Solomon's cell phone went dead before we got a location. His other number appears to be a disposable phone, which is almost impossible to track. The private jet company told us that Langdon's flight was booked by Solomon's assistant on Solomon's cell phone, with Solomon's marquee jet card. There is no trail. Not that it matters anyway. Even if we find out exactly where he is, I can't possibly risk moving in and trying to grab him.
Why not?
I prefer not to share that as the information is classified,
Sato said, patience clearly waning.
I'm asking you to trust me on this.
Well, I don't.
Sato's eyes were like ice. She turned suddenly and shouted across the jungle.
Agent Hartman! The briefcase, please.
Bellamy heard the hiss of the electronic door, and an agent strode into the jungle. He was carrying a sleek titanium briefcase, which he set on the ground beside the OS director.
Leave us,
Sato said. As the agent departed, the door hissed again, and then everything fell silent. Sato picked up the metal case, laid it across her lap, and popped the clasps. Then she raised her eyes slowly to Bellamy.
I did not want to do this, but our time is running out, and you've left me no choice.
Bellamy eyed the strange briefcase and felt a swell of fear.
Is she going to torture me?
He strained at his cuffs again.
What's in that case?
Sato smiled grimly.
Something that will persuade you to see things my way. I guarantee it.
Chapter 81. The subterranean space in which Malak performed the art was ingeniously hidden. His home's basement, to those who entered, appeared quite normal. A typical cellar with boiler, fuse box, wood pile, and a hodgepodge of storage. This visible cellar, however, was only a portion of Malak's underground space. A sizable area had been walled off for his clandestine practices. Malak's private workspace was a suite of small rooms, each with a specialized purpose. The area's sole entrance was a steep ramp secretly accessible through his living room, making the area's discovery virtually impossible. Tonight, as Malak descended the ramp, the tattooed sigils and signs on his flesh seemed to come alive in the cerulean glow of his basement's specialized lighting. Moving into the bluish haze, he walked past several closed doors and headed directly for the largest room at the end of the corridor. The Sanctum Sanctorum, as Malak liked to call it, was a perfect 12-foot square.
12 are the signs of the zodiac. 12 are the hours of the day. 12 are the gates of heaven.
In the center of the chamber was a stone table, a 7x7 square.
7 are the seals of Revelation. 7 are the steps of the temple.
Centered over the table hung a carefully calibrated light source that cycled through a spectrum of preordained colors, completing its cycle every 6 hours in accordance with the sacred table of planetary hours.
The hour of Yanor is blue. The hour of Nesnia is red. The hour of Salam is white.
Now was the hour of Kyera, meaning the light in the room had modulated to a soft, purplish hue. Wearing only a silken loincloth wrapped around his buttocks and neutered sex organ, Malak began his preparations. He carefully combined the suffumigation chemicals that he would later ignite to sanctify the air. Then he folded the virgin silk robe that he would eventually don in place of his loincloth. And finally, he purified a flask of water for the anointing of his offering. When he was done, he placed all of these prepared ingredients on a side table. Next he went to a shelf and retrieved a small ivory box which he carried to the side table and placed with the other items. Although he was not yet ready to use it, He could not resist opening the lid and admiring this treasure.
The knife.
Inside the ivory box, nestled in a cradle of black velvet, shone the sacrificial knife that Moloch had been saving for tonight. He had purchased it for $1.6 million on the Middle Eastern Antiquities black market last year.
The most famous knife in history.
Unimaginably old and believed lost, this precious blade was made of iron attached to a bone handle. Over the ages, it had been in the possession of countless powerful individuals. In recent decades, however, it had disappeared, languishing in a secret private collection. Moloch had gone to enormous lengths to obtain it. The knife, he suspected, had not drawn blood for decades, possibly centuries. Tonight, this blade would again taste the power of the sacrifice for which it was honed. Moloch gently lifted the knife from its cushioned compartment and reverently polished the blade with a silk cloth soaked in purified water. His skills had progressed greatly since his first rudimentary experiments in New York. The dark art that Moloch practiced had been known by many names in many languages, but by any name, it was a precise science. This primeval technology had once held the key to the portals of power, but it had been banished long ago, relegated to the shadows of occultism and magic. Those few who still practiced this art were considered madmen, but Moloch knew better. This is not work for those with dull faculties. The ancient dark art, like modern science, was a discipline involving precise formulas, specific ingredients, and meticulous timing. This art was not the impotent black magic of today, often practiced half-heartedly by curious souls. This art, like nuclear physics, had the potential to unleash enormous power. The warnings were dire. The unskilled practitioner runs the risk of being struck by a reflux current and destroyed. Moloch finished admiring the obsidian blade and turned his attention to a lone sheet of thick vellum lying on the table before him. He had made this vellum himself from the skin of a baby lamb. As was the protocol, the lamb was pure, having not yet reached sexual maturity. Beside the vellum was a quill pen he had made from the feather of a crow, a silver saucer, and three glimmering candles arranged around a solid brass bowl. The bowl contained 1 inch of thick crimson liquid. The liquid was Peter Solomon's blood. Blood is the tincture of eternity. Moloch picked up the quill pen, placed his left hand on the vellum, and dipping the quill tip in the blood, he carefully traced the outline of his open palm. When he was done, he added the 5 symbols of the ancient mysteries, 1 on each fingertip of the drawing. The crown, to represent the king I shall become. The star, to represent the heavens which have ordained my destiny. The sun, to represent the illumination of my soul. The lantern, to represent the feeble light of human understanding, and the key, to represent the missing piece, that which tonight I shall at last possess. Moloch completed his blood tracing and held up the vellum, admiring his work in the light of the 3 candles. He waited until the blood was dry, and then folded the thick vellum 3 times. While chanting an ethereal ancient incantation, Moloch touched the vellum to the 3rd candle, and it burst into flames. He set the flaming vellum on the silver saucer and let it burn. As it did, the carbon in the animal skin dissolved to a powdery black char. When the flame went out, Moloch carefully tapped the ashes into the brass bowl of blood. Then he stirred the mixture with the crow's feather. The liquid turned a deeper crimson, nearly black. Holding the bowl in both palms, Moloch raised it over his head and gave thanks, intoning the blood Eucharistos of the ancients. Then he carefully poured the blackened mixture into a glass vial and corked it. This would be the ink with which Moloch would inscribe the untattooed flesh atop his head and complete his masterpiece. Chapter 82. Washington National Cathedral is the 6th largest cathedral in the world and soars higher than a 30-story skyscraper. Embellished with over 200 stained glass windows, a 53-bell carillon and a 10,647 pipe organ, this Gothic masterpiece can accommodate more than 3,000 worshippers. Tonight, however, the great cathedral was deserted. Reverend Colin Galloway, dean of the cathedral, looked like he had been alive forever. Stooped and withered, he wore a simple black cassock and shuffled blindly ahead without a word. Langdon and Catherine followed in silence through the darkness of the 400-foot-long nave's central aisle, which was curved ever so slightly to the left to create a softening optical illusion. When they reached the great crossing, the dean guided them through the rood screen, the symbolic divider between the public area and the sanctuary beyond. The scent of frankincense hung in the air of the chancel. This sacred space was dark, illuminated only by indirect reflections in the foliated vaults overhead. Flags of the 50 states hung above the choir, which was ornately appointed with several carved reredos depicting biblical events. Dean Galloway continued on, apparently knowing this walk by heart. For a moment, Langdon thought they were headed straight for the high altar, where the 10 stones from Mount Sinai were embedded. But the old dean finally turned left and groped his way through a discreetly hidden door that led into an administrative annex. They moved down a short hallway to an office door bearing a brass nameplate. The Reverend Dr. Colin Galloway, Cathedral Dean. Galloway opened the door and turned on the lights, apparently accustomed to remembering this courtesy for his guests. He ushered them in and closed the door. The dean's office was small but elegant, with high bookshelves, a desk, a carved armoire, and a private bathroom. On the walls hung 16th-century tapestries and several religious paintings. The old dean motioned to the two leather chairs directly opposite his desk. Langdon sat with Catherine and felt grateful finally to set his heavy shoulder bag on the floor at his feet. Sanctuary and answers, Langdon thought, settling into the comfortable chair. The aged man shuffled around behind his desk and eased himself down into his high-backed chair. Then, with a weary sigh, he raised his head, staring blankly out at them through clouded eyes. When he spoke, his voice was unexpectedly clear and strong. "I realize we have never met," the old man said, "and yet I feel I know you both." He took out a handkerchief and dabbed his mouth. "Professor Langdon, I am familiar with your writings, including the clever piece you did on the symbolism of this cathedral. And, Miss Solomon, your brother Peter and I have been Masonic brothers for many years now."
"Peter is in terrible trouble," Catherine said.
"So I have been told," the old man sighed. "And I will do everything in my power to help you."
Langdon saw no Masonic ring on the dean's finger, and yet he knew many Masons, especially those within the clergy, chose not to advertise their affiliation. As they began to talk, it became clear that Dean Galloway already knew some of the night's events from Warren Bellamy's phone message. As Langdon and Catherine filled him in on the rest, the dean looked more and more troubled.
"And this man who has taken our beloved Peter," the dean said, "he is insisting you decipher the pyramid in exchange for Peter's life?"
"Yes," Langdon said. "He thinks it's a map that will lead him to the hiding place of the ancient mysteries." The dean turned his eerie, opaque eyes toward Langdon.
"My ears tell me you do not believe in such things."
Langdon did not want to waste time going down this road. "It doesn't matter what I believe. We need to help Peter. Unfortunately, when we deciphered the pyramid, it pointed nowhere."
The old man sat straighter. "You've deciphered the pyramid?"
Catherine interceded now, quickly explaining that despite Bellamy's warnings and her brother's request that Langdon not unwrap the package, she had done so, feeling her first priority was to help her brother however she could. She told the dean about the golden capstone, Albrecht Dürer's magic square, and how it decrypted the 16-letter Masonic cipher into the phrase, "Jehovah Sanctus Unus."
"That's all it says?" the dean asked. "One true God?"
"Yes, sir," Langdon replied. "Apparently the pyramid is more of a metaphorical map than a geographic one." The dean held out his hands.
"Let me feel it."
Langdon unzipped his bag and pulled out the pyramid, which he carefully hoisted up on the desk, setting it directly in front of the Reverend.
Langdon and Catherine watched as the old man's frail hands examined every inch of the stone. The engraved side, the smooth base, and the truncated top. When he was finished, he held out his hands again. And the capstone? Langdon retrieved the small stone box, set it on the desk, and opened the lid. Then he removed the capstone and placed it into the old man's waiting hands. The dean performed a similar examination, feeling every inch, pausing on the capstone's engraving, apparently having some trouble reading the small, elegantly inscribed text. "The secret hides within the order," Langdon offered. "And the words the and order are capitalized." The old man's face was expressionless as he positioned the capstone on top of the pyramid and aligned it by sense of touch. He seemed to pause a moment, as if in prayer, and reverently ran his palms over the complete pyramid several times. Then he reached out and located the cube-shaped box, taking it in his hands, feeling it carefully, his fingers probing inside and out. When he was done, he set down the box and leaned back in his chair. "So tell me," he demanded, his voice suddenly stern, "why have you come to me?" The question took Langdon off guard.
"We came, sir, because you told us to, and Mr. Bellamy said we should trust you."
"And yet you did not trust him."
"I'm sorry?"
The dean's white eyes stared directly through Langdon. "The package containing the capstone was sealed. Mr. Bellamy told you not to open it, and yet you did. In addition, Peter Solomon himself told you not to open it, and yet you did."
"Sir," Catherine intervened, "we were trying to help my brother. The man who has him demanded we decipher—"
"I can appreciate that," the dean declared. "And yet what have you achieved by opening the package?"
"Nothing. Peter's captor is looking for a location, and he will not be satisfied with the answer of Jehovah Sanctus Unus."
"I agree," Langdon said. "But unfortunately, that's all the pyramid says. As I mentioned, the map seems to be more figurative than—"
"You're mistaken, Professor," the dean said. "The Masonic pyramid is a real map. It points to a real location. You do not understand that because you have not yet deciphered the pyramid fully. Not even close."
Langdon and Catherine exchanged startled looks. The dean laid his hands back on the pyramid, almost caressing it.
"This map, like the ancient mysteries themselves, has many layers of meaning. Its true secret remains veiled from you."
"Dean Galloway," Langdon said, "we've been over every inch of the pyramid and capstone, and there's nothing else to see."
"Not in its current state, no. But objects change."
"Sir?"
"Professor, as you know, the promise of this pyramid is one of miraculous transformative power. Legend holds that this pyramid can change its shape, alter its physical form to reveal its secrets, like the famed stone that released Excalibur into the hands of King Arthur. The Masonic pyramid can transform itself, if it so chooses, and reveal its secret to the worthy."
Langdon now sensed that the old man's advanced years had perhaps robbed him of his faculties.
"I'm sorry, sir, are you saying this pyramid can undergo a literal, physical transformation?"
"Professor, if I were to reach out with my hand and transform this pyramid right before your eyes, would you believe what you had witnessed?"
Langdon had no idea how to respond.
"I suppose I would have no choice."
"Very well, then. In a moment I shall do exactly that."
He dabbed his mouth again.
"Let me remind you that there was an era when even the brightest minds perceived the earth as flat. For if the earth were round, then surely the oceans would spill off. Imagine how they would have mocked you if you proclaimed, 'Not only is the world a sphere, but there is an invisible, mystical force that holds everything to its surface.'"
"There's a difference," Langdon said, "between the existence of gravity and the ability to transform objects with the touch of your hand."
"Is there? Is it not possible that we are still living in the dark ages, still mocking the suggestion of mystical forces that we cannot see or comprehend? History, if it has taught us anything at all, has taught us that the strange ideas we deride today will one day be our celebrated truths."
I claim I can transform this pyramid with a touch of my finger, and you question my sanity. I would expect more from a historian. History is replete with great minds who have all proclaimed the same thing. Great minds who have all insisted that man possesses mystical abilities of which he is unaware.
Langdon knew the dean was correct. The famous Hermetic aphorism, "Know ye not that ye are gods?" was one of the pillars of the ancient mysteries. As above, so below. Man created in God's image, apotheosis. This persistent message of man's own divinity, of his hidden potential, was the recurring theme in the ancient texts of countless traditions. Even the Holy Bible cried out in Psalms 82:6, "Ye are gods." "Professor," the old man said, "I realize that you, like many educated people, live trapped between worlds, one foot in the spiritual, one foot in the physical. Your heart yearns to believe, but your intellect refuses to permit it. As an academic, you would be wise to learn from the great minds of history." He paused and cleared his throat. "If I'm remembering correctly, one of the greatest minds ever to live proclaimed, 'That which is impenetrable to us really exists. Behind the secrets of nature remains something subtle, intangible, and inexplicable. Veneration for this force beyond anything that we can comprehend is my religion.'"
"Who said that?" Langdon said. "Gandhi?"
"No," Catherine interjected. "Albert Einstein."
Catherine Solomon had read every word Einstein had ever written, and was struck by his profound respect for the mystical, as well as his predictions that the masses would one day feel the same. "The religion of the future," Einstein had predicted, "will be a cosmic religion. It will transcend personal God and avoid dogma and theology." Robert Langdon appeared to be struggling with the idea. Catherine could sense his rising frustration with the old Episcopal priest, and she understood. After all, they had traveled here for answers, and they had found instead a blind man who claimed he could transform objects with a touch of his hands. Even so, the old man's overt passion for mystical forces reminded Catherine of her brother.
"Father Galloway," Catherine said, "Peter is in trouble. The CIA is chasing us, and Warren Bellamy sent us to you for help. I don't know what this pyramid says or where it points, but if deciphering it means that we can help Peter, we need to do that. Mr. Bellamy may have preferred to sacrifice my brother's life to hide this pyramid, but my family has experienced nothing but pain because of it. Whatever secret it may hold, it ends tonight."
"You are correct," the old man replied, his tone dire. "It will all end tonight. You've guaranteed that."
He sighed.
"Miss Solomon, when you broke the seal on that box, you set in motion a series of events from which there will be no return. There are forces at work tonight that you do not yet comprehend. There is no turning back."
Catherine stared dumbfounded at the Reverend. There was something apocalyptic about his tone, as if he were referring to the seven seals of Revelation or Pandora's box.
"Respectfully, sir," Langdon interceded, "I can't imagine how a stone pyramid could set in motion anything at all."
"Of course you can't, Professor."
The old man stared blindly through him.
"You do not yet have eyes to see."
Chapter 83. In the moist air of the jungle, the architect of the capital could feel the sweat now rolling down his back. His handcuffed wrists ached, but all of his attention remained riveted on the ominous titanium briefcase that Sato had just opened on the bench between them.
"The contents of this case," Sato had told him, "will persuade you to see things my way. I guarantee it."
The tiny Asian woman had unclasped the metal case away from Bellamy's line of sight, and he had yet to see its contents, but his imagination was running wild. Sato's hands were doing something inside the case, and Bellamy half expected her to extract a series of glistening, razor-sharp tools. Suddenly a light source flickered inside the case, growing brighter, illuminating Sato's face from beneath. Her hands kept moving inside, and the light changed hue. After a few moments, she removed her hands, grasped the entire case, and turned it toward Bellamy so he could see inside. Bellamy found himself squinting into the glow of what appeared to be some kind of futuristic laptop, with a handheld phone receiver, two antennae, and a double keyboard. His initial surge of relief turned quickly to confusion. The screen bore the CIA logo and the text, Secure Login. User, Inoue Sato. Security Clearance, Level 5. Beneath the laptop's login window, a progress icon was spinning. One moment, please. Decrypting file. Bellamy's gaze shot back up to Sato, whose eyes were locked on his.
I had not wanted to show you this, she said, but you've left me no choice.
The screen flickered again, and Bellamy glanced back down as the file opened, its contents filling the entire LCD. For several moments, Bellamy stared at the screen, trying to make sense of what he was looking at. Gradually, as it began to dawn on him, he felt the blood draining from his face. He stared in horror, unable to look away.
But this is impossible, he exclaimed. How could this be?
Sato's face was grim.
You tell me, Mr. Bellamy. You tell me.
As the architect of the Capitol began to fully comprehend the ramifications of what he was seeing, he could feel his entire world teetering precariously on the brink of disaster.
My God, I've made a terrible, terrible mistake.
Chapter 84. Dean Galloway felt alive. Like all mortals, he knew the time was coming when he would shed his mortal shell, but tonight was not the night. His corporeal heart was beating strong and fast, and his mind felt sharp. There's work to be done. As he ran his arthritic hands across the pyramid's smooth surfaces, he could scarcely believe what he was feeling. I never imagined I would live to witness this moment. For generations, the pieces of the Symbolon map had been kept safely apart from one another. Now they were united at last. Galloway wondered if this was the foretold time. Strangely, fate had selected two non-Masons to assemble the pyramid. Somehow, this seemed fitting. The mysteries are moving out of the inner circles, out of darkness, into the light.
Professor, he said, turning his head in the direction of Langdon's breathing, did Peter tell you why he wanted you to watch over the little package?
He said powerful people wanted to steal it from him, Langdon replied. The dean nodded.
Yes, Peter told me the same thing.
He did?
Catherine said suddenly on his left.
You and my brother spoke about this pyramid?
Of course, Galloway said. Your brother and I have spoken on many things. I was once the worshipful master at the House of the Temple, and he comes to me for guidance at times. It was about a year ago that he came to me deeply troubled. He sat exactly where you are now, and he asked me if I believed in supernatural premonitions.
Premonitions?
Catherine sounded concerned.
You mean like visions?
Not exactly. It was more visceral. Peter said he was feeling the growing presence of a dark force in his life. He sensed something was watching him, waiting, intending to do him great harm.
Obviously he was right, Catherine said, considering that the same man who killed our mother and Peter's son had come to Washington and become one of Peter's own Masonic brothers.
True, Langdon said. But it doesn't explain the involvement of the CIA. Galloway was not so sure.
Men in power are always interested in greater power.
But the CIA? Langdon challenged. And mystical secrets? Something doesn't add up.
Sure it does, Catherine said. The CIA thrives on technological advancement, and has always experimented with the mystical sciences. ESP, remote viewing, sensory deprivation, pharmacologically induced highly mentalized states. It's all the same thing, tapping the unseen potential of the human mind. If there's one thing I've learned from Peter, it's this. Science and mysticism are very closely related, distinguishable only by their approaches. They have identical goals, but different methods.
Peter tells me,
Galloway said, that your field of study is a kind of modern mystical science.
Noetics, Catherine said, nodding. And it's proving man has powers unlike anything we can imagine.
She motioned to a stained glass window depicting the familiar image of the luminous Jesus, that of Christ with rays of light flowing from his head and hands.
In fact, I just used a super-cooled charge-coupled device to photograph the hands of a faith healer at work. The photos looked a lot like the image of Jesus in your stained glass window, streams of energy pouring through the healer's fingertips.
The well-trained mind, Galloway thought, hiding a smile. How do you think Jesus healed the sick?
I realize, Catherine said, that modern medicine ridicules healers and shamans, but I saw this with my own eyes. My CCD cameras clearly photographed this man transmitting a massive energy field from his fingertips and literally changing the cellular makeup of his patient. If that's not godlike power, then I don't know what is.
Dean Galloway let himself smile. Catherine had the same fiery passion as her brother.
Peter once compared noetic scientists to the early explorers who were mocked for embracing the heretical notion of a spherical earth. Almost overnight, these explorers went from fools to heroes, discovering uncharted worlds and expanding the horizons of everyone on the planet. Peter thinks you will do this as well. He has very high hopes for your work. After all, every great philosophical shift in history began with a single bold idea.
Galloway knew, of course, that one needn't go to a lab to witness proof of this bold new idea, this proposal of man's untapped potential. This very cathedral held healing prayer circles for the sick and repeatedly had witnessed truly miraculous results, medically documented physical transformations. The question was not whether God had imbued man with great powers, but rather how we liberate those powers. The old dean placed his hands reverently around the sides of the Masonic pyramid and spoke very quietly.
My friends, I do not know exactly where this pyramid points, but I do know this. There is a great spiritual treasure buried out there somewhere, a treasure that has waited patiently in darkness for generations. I believe it is a catalyst that has the power to transform this world.
He now touched the golden tip of the capstone.
And now that this pyramid is assembled, the time is fast approaching. And why shouldn't it? The promise of a great transformational enlightenment has been prophesied forever.
Father, Langdon said, his tone challenging, we're all familiar with the revelation of St. John and the literal meaning of the apocalypse, but biblical prophecy hardly seems...
Oh, heavens! The book of Revelation is a mess, the dean said. Nobody knows how to read that. I'm talking about clear minds writing in clear language. The predictions of St. Augustine, Sir Francis Bacon, Newton, Einstein. The list goes on and on. All anticipating a transformative moment of enlightenment. Even Jesus himself said, nothing is hidden that will not be made known, nor secret that will not come to light.
It's a safe prediction to make, Langdon said. Knowledge grows exponentially. The more we know, the greater our ability to learn, and the faster we expand our knowledge base.
Yes, Catherine added, we see this in science all the time. Each new technology we invent becomes a tool with which to invent new technologies, and it snowballs. That's why science has advanced more in the last 5 years than in the previous 5,000. Exponential growth. Mathematically, as time passes, the exponential curve of progress becomes almost vertical, and new development occurs incredibly fast.
Silence fell in the dean's office, and Galloway sensed that his two guests still had no idea how this pyramid could possibly help them reveal anything further.
That is why fate brought you to me, he thought. I have a role to play.
For many years, the Reverend Colin Galloway, along with his Masonic brothers, had played the role of gatekeeper. Now it was all changing.
I am no longer a gatekeeper. I am a guide.
Professor Langdon, Galloway said, reaching out across his desk,
take my hand, if you will.
Robert Langdon felt uncertain as he stared across at Dean Galloway's outstretched palm. Are we going to pray? Politely, Langdon reached out and placed his right hand in the dean's withered hand.
The old man grasped it firmly, but did not begin to pray. Instead, he found Langdon's index finger and guided it downward into the stone box that had once housed the golden capstone.
"Your eyes have blinded you," the dean said. "If you saw with your fingertips as I do, you would realize this box has something left to teach you."
Dutifully, Langdon worked his fingertip around the inside of the box, but he felt nothing. The inside was perfectly smooth.
"Keep looking," Galloway prompted.
Finally, Langdon's fingertip felt something, a tiny raised circle, a minuscule dot in the center of the base of the box. He removed his hand and peered inside. The little circle was virtually invisible to the naked eye.
"What is that?" "Do you recognize that symbol?" Galloway asked.
"Symbol?" Langdon replied. "I can barely see anything at all."
"Push down on it."
Langdon did as he asked, pressing his fingertip down onto the spot.
"What does he think will happen?"
"Hold your finger down," the dean said. "Apply pressure."
Langdon glanced over at Catherine, who looked puzzled as she tucked a wisp of hair behind her ears. A few seconds later, the old man finally nodded.
"Okay, remove your hand. The alchemy is complete."
"Alchemy?"
Robert Langdon removed his hand from the stone box and sat in bewildered silence. Nothing had changed at all. The box just sat there on the desk.
"Nothing," Langdon said.
"Look at your fingertip," the dean replied. "You should see a transformation."
Langdon looked at his finger, but the only transformation he could see was that he now had an indentation on his skin made by the circular nubbin, a tiny circle with a dot in the middle.
"Now, do you recognize this symbol?" the dean asked.
Although Langdon recognized the symbol, he was more impressed that the dean had been able to feel the detail of it. Seeing with one's fingertips was apparently a learned skill.
"It's alchemical," Catherine said, sliding her chair closer and examining Langdon's finger. "It's the ancient symbol for gold."
"Indeed it is," the dean smiled and patted the box. "Professor, congratulations, you have just achieved what every alchemist in history has strived for. From a worthless substance, you've created gold."
Langdon frowned, unimpressed. The little parlor trick seemed to be no help at all.
"An interesting idea, sir, but I'm afraid this symbol, a circle with a round dot in the middle, has dozens of meanings. It's called a circumpunct, and it's one of the most widely used symbols in history."
"What are you talking about?"
the dean asked, sounding skeptical.
Langdon was stunned that a mason was not more familiar with the spiritual importance of this symbol.
"Sir, the circumpunct has countless meanings. In ancient Egypt, it was the symbol for Ra, the sun god, and modern astronomy still uses it as the solar symbol. In Eastern philosophy, it represents the spiritual insight of the third eye, the divine rose, and the sign of illumination. The Kabbalists use it to symbolize the Keter, the highest Sfirot, and the most hidden of all hidden things. Early mystics called it the Eye of God, and it's the origin of the all-seeing eye on the Great Seal. The Pythagoreans used the circumpunct as the symbol of the Maneb, the divine truth, the Prisca Sapientia, the atonement of mind and soul.
And the..." "Enough!" Dean Galloway was chuckling now. "Professor, thank you. You are correct, of course."
Langdon now realized he had just been played. He knew all that.
"The circumpunct," Galloway said, still smiling to himself, "is essentially the symbol of the ancient mysteries. For this reason, I would suggest that its presence in this box is not mere coincidence. Legend holds that the secrets of this map are hidden in the smallest of details."
"Fine," Catherine said. "But even if this symbol was inscribed there intentionally, it doesn't bring us any closer to deciphering the map, does it?"
"You mentioned earlier that the wax seal you broke was embossed with Peter's ring?"
"That's correct."
"And you said you have that ring with you?"
"I do."
Langdon reached into his pocket, found the ring, took it out of the plastic bag, and placed it on the desk in front of the dean. Galloway picked up the ring and began feeling its surfaces.
"This unique ring was created at the same time as the Masonic pyramid, and traditionally, it is worn by the mason in charge of protecting the pyramid." Tonight, when I felt the tiny circumpunct on the bottom of the stone box, I realized that the ring is, in fact, part of the Symbolon.
It is?
I'm certain of it. Peter is my closest friend, and he wore this ring for many years. I am quite familiar with it.
He handed the ring to Langdon.
See for yourself.
Langdon took the ring and examined it, running his fingers over the double-headed phoenix, the number 33, the words Ordo ab Kau, and also the words All is revealed at the 33rd degree. He felt nothing helpful. Then, as his fingers traced down around the outside of the band, he stopped short. Startled, he turned the ring over and eyed the very bottom of its band.
"Did you find it?" Galloway said.
"I think so, yes," Langdon said. Catherine slid her chair closer.
"What?"
"The degree sign on the band," Langdon said, showing her. "It's so small that you don't really notice it with your eyes, but if you feel it, you can tell it's actually indented, like a tiny circular incision."
The degree sign was centered on the bottom of the band, and admittedly looked to be the same size as the raised nubbin in the bottom of the cube.
"Is it the same size?" Catherine moved closer still, sounding excited now.
"There's one way to find out."
He took the ring and lowered it into the box, aligning the two tiny circles. As he pushed down, the raised circle on the box slid into the ring's opening, and there was a faint but decisive click. They all jumped.
Langdon waited, but nothing happened.
"What was that?" the priest said.
"Nothing," Catherine replied. "The ring locked into place, but nothing else happened."
"No great transformation?"
Galloway looked puzzled.
"We're not done," Langdon realized, gazing down at the ring's embossed insignia, a double-headed phoenix and the number 33. All is revealed at the 33rd degree. His mind filled with thoughts of Pythagoras, sacred geometry, and angles. He wondered if perhaps degrees had a mathematical meaning. Slowly, heart beating faster now, he reached down and grasped the ring, which was affixed to the base of the cube. Then slowly he began turning the ring to the right. All is revealed at the 33rd degree. He turned the ring 10 degrees, 20 degrees, 30 degrees. What happened next, Langdon never saw coming.
Chapter 85. Transformation. Dean Galloway heard it happen, and so he didn't need to see it. Across the desk from him, Langdon and Catherine were dead silent, no doubt staring in mute astonishment at the stone cube, which had just transformed itself loudly before their very eyes. Galloway couldn't help but smile. He had anticipated the result, and although he still had no idea how this development would ultimately help them solve the riddle of the pyramid, he was enjoying the rare chance to teach a Harvard symbologist something about symbols.
"Professor," the dean said, "few people realize that the Masons venerate the shape of the cube, or ashlar as we call it, because it is a three-dimensional representation of another symbol, a much older two-dimensional symbol."
Galloway didn't need to ask if the professor recognized the ancient symbol now lying before them on the desk. It was one of the most famous symbols in the world. Robert Langdon's thoughts churned as he stared at the transformed box on the desk in front of him. "I had no idea." Moments ago, he had reached into the stone box, grasped the Masonic ring, and gently turned it. As he rotated the ring through 33 degrees, the cube had suddenly changed before his eyes. The square panels that made up the sides of the box fell away from one another as their hidden hinges released. The box collapsed all at once, its side panels and lid falling outward, slapping loudly on the desk.
"The cube becomes a cross," Langdon thought. "Symbolic alchemy."
Catherine looked bewildered by the sight of the collapsed cube.
"The Masonic pyramid relates to Christianity?"
For a moment, Langdon had wondered the same thing. After all, the Christian crucifix was a respected symbol within the Masons, and certainly there were plenty of Christian Masons. However, Masons were also Jews, Muslims, Buddhists, Hindus, and those who had no name for their god.
The presence of an exclusively Christian symbol seemed restrictive. Then the true meaning of this symbol had dawned on him.
"It's not a crucifix," Langdon said.